story on the retrieval of the air crewmen's bodies, as it was told to me, was that back in April of 69, the two Seawolf helicopters had been engaged in a firefight, or support of a firefight, along the Cambodian-Vietnamese border. Somewhere, as again I'm guessing, but I think it was somewhere in the Whiskey Tango 6 through the Whiskey Tango 8 area, east of the Parrot's Peak. Anyway, in setting up their racetrack pattern, they set it up to where they crossed the, they flew over the Cambodian border, and a Cambodian captain, I believe at the time he was a lieutenant, opened fire with anti-aircraft batteries and shot both aircraft down. Sometime later, of course at the time it was an international incident, and sometime later there was a big hoop-de-doo about returning the remains of the pilots and air crewmen to the Americans. It was done done by the Cambodian government to the government of the United States at a border crossing somewhere near Tay Ninh, as I recall. And it was a big propaganda scene with the communist photographers and newsreelers, et cetera, showing the what nice guys the Cambodians were to return the bodies of these people. It was such a long time afterward, though, that the bodies of the pilots and air crewmen had been in the ground for so long that the remains had deteriorated, and what was really returned was a number of bones. The positive identification of the people was not possible, of all the people, was not possible on the basis of the bones that were returned at the time of the big hoopla. Therefore, in June of 1970, during the Cambodian invasion, the parents of those people who, or those Seawolf people who could not be identified from the bones returned earlier, had requested the Navy to, while the Americans were in Cambodia, to recover more of the bones so that positive identification could be made of the remains and that all the insurance claims, et cetera, could be paid off. Debt 4 and Debt 7 were assigned the same Cambodian captain whose batteries, when he was a lieutenant, had shot down the Seawolf pilots, Seawolf aircraft. As it turned out, this Cambodian captain was a pretty nice guy. I think all of us, when we first met him, were at least apprehensive, and probably some other thoughts went through our minds when we thought that this guy had killed some of our people, but as it turned out, he was he ended up being well received by almost everybody. For about a week or 10 days, we had continuous daily operations with this Cambodian captain in trying to find the crash site and the burial site of the crewmen. We were not successful, mainly for a number of reasons. It had been 2 years or over a year, well over a year, and the crash site was obliterated. The aircraft itself had been, the aircrafts themselves had been moved. One part of the plane of reeds looks like just like any other. And of course, the ever constant presence of the battles raging around us, the North Vietnamese being chased down by the army units in Cambodia. All of these things kept us from really being successful. That we did find the site of one group of graves, I guess, and they dug them up, and all they recovered was a few bones, and as I understand it, not enough bones were recovered to again make positive identification. So the whole thing was a significant effort in terms of time and money, but it didn't yield the results that the Navy wanted. Well, that's a little sidelight to Cambodian incursion. I'll stop here for a second. Before I continue on with some of your technical questions, I'll ask or answer, try attempt to answer your last question of what level of resistance did the Sea Wolves meet in while we were in Cambodia. Of course, on that river there, that was the most significant resistance. The boats were damn lucky to get through that. And of course, that was early on in the operation. Thereafter, it seemed to be kind of a manhunt. The Army making sweeps through various areas and sometimes encountering resistance, mainly just simply finding stores and headquarters and equipment, etc. The North Vietnamese that were in the Cambodian sanctuary areas tended to dissolve and flee inland or flee into outlying areas. Very little overall resistance was encountered. It was scattered actions, brief and fierce firefights, and then the enemy would dissolve and blend or try to get away. I personally believe that there were not many casualties sustained by the North Vietnamese. The main damage that was done to them was the uncovery and capture of vast stockpiles of their supplies. I remember a couple times in flying some of our patrols, we sighted from the air stockpiles of everything from uniforms to trucks and this kind of thing, and we would pinpoint them, radio them to the Army, and the Army would send somebody in to capture them and destroy them. It was that kind of thing, not so much raging battles. But the only time, in fact, that I ever saw an organized unit was a real surprise. We were flying on a patrol in Cambodia, and trucking down this dirt road was a company, about 100 men, of North Vietnamese in perfect parade formation in uniform. We were so shocked, and they were so shocked, that I think that we turned around and put a strike in on them, but we... reacted so slowly that I doubt very seriously if we got many of them. They stopped, looked at us, we looked at them, and they ran off the road, and about a minute later, we rolled in. But that was the one and only time I ever saw an organized unit like that. The rest of the time, I remember another case where we were called to support some Army troops who were in a field. And the North Vietnamese had a mortar in a pagoda, the top floor of a pagoda that overlooked the area. And we shot up the pagoda, the top floor of the pagoda, with our rockets, silencing that mortar so that the Army troops in the open there could continue their advance. But mainly it was that kind of thing. I think the North Vietnamese just put delaying or troops with a delaying assignment, left them behind, and the rest of the main bodies retreated. Okay, I'll go on to some of your more technical questions here, and I don't know how much help I'm going to be to you. Hold on just a minute, and I'll get a little organized. Your first question asks, can I pinpoint the date that the 50 cal and minigun first began to appear in HAL 3? I don't know about squadron-wide. I can comment a little bit on what we did at DET 4. We had an excellent ordnanceman and electrician, and I remember shortly after I got to DET 4 in the spring, March or April, somewhere around there, they were toying around with a minigun, and they got it to work, and we used it. There were some problems, of course. Getting it to swivel and getting it to, the main problem was electrical fires. The way they had it worked up, they stuck it on the battery circuit, and it caused, it blew fuses for a while, and then it caused several fires, and I believe it never was adopted I remember in Cambodia when we in June when we went into Cambodia, we were flying with M60 machine guns, I believe. I don't think we had the minigun rigged, but all throughout that period of the spring there, I remember those two enlisted men toying around with that door-mounted minigun. I have no idea whether it was original work on their part or whether they were borrowing the idea from somebody else, though. 50 cal, about the same time. They were, these same guys were mounting a 50 cal on the side. And we did use that. That became a standard piece of equipment. The 50 caliber machine gun had some problems in that, of course, it had such a high thrust that it tended to sometimes do airframe damage and just buckling the plates and this kind of thing. And also when there were accuracy problems when you fired the thing out the side, there was so much kick to it that it skidded the aircraft quite a bit. But the crewman got good at using it, and we, in fact, had it mounted on one of our aircraft throughout most of the period that I was at Det 4. The advantage to the 50 cal, of course, was that it was a low-cost alternative to rockets for use against bunkers, lightweight bunkers and light structures. The kind of ammunition we liked the most was APIT, armor-piercing incendiary tracer, which featured all the, which gave it an anti-personnel characteristic too, a capability, I mean, since it, when it hit, it exploded. Let's see, I think that's about all I can say on the, on those questions. I wish I'd been more observant. You ask about, my return to, Bentui and the Sea Lords. I went on R&R down to Sydney and, about July, I believe, and went to transfer to Bentui in August to finish up my last few months in country there. We had four UH-1Ls, as I recall, and there were no HH-1Ks. In fact, I had never, your mention of them was the first I'd heard of those aircraft at Bentui. There were not any of them assigned to, through October of 70. They must have come afterward. You'll have to ask someone else about the HH-1Ks. You ask about hard points on the Sea Lords. During the period I was there, August through October, Captain Twight did want one of them fitted to give them an attack capability, not necessarily to be used as an attack aircraft, but to give them an attack capability, mainly in, so that they could support SEAL operations. Captain Twight was big on trying to use the Sea Lords as slick insertion birds with SEAL teams for all kinds of different operations, in conjunction with the Sea Wolf DETs. The Sea Wolves would provide air cover for the SEAL insertions, mainly down in the Kamau Peninsula. As I mentioned earlier, starting sometime in the middle of the year, I guess around June or so, the Vietnamese Marines began an operation against the 9th NVA Division and the Viet Cong in the U Minh Forest and in the Kamau Peninsula in general. And we moved two DETs down to Song An Dak, and or that area, and I believe one was at Kamau and one was at Song An Dak. And to support those activities, they moved some boats down there, a couple divisions of boats down there, and all to support this operation against the U Minh Forest. And Captain Twight wanted the Sea Lords to have a capability of doing SEAL ops down there. In fact, I was the schedules officer, that was my duty at Bentui, and I began a training program where I trained hacks and other people that were rotating in from the DETs in on how to do SEAL insertions. It was kind of a scratch thing. I went out and learned it myself, and then came back and started teaching other guys, including Captain Twight. I can tell you a few funny stories about Captain Twight trying to do some seal insertions, but I'll let that wait if you like. As to your specific question about when they were fitted out as hardpoint aircraft so they could carry rocket pods, they may have been fitted out during that time period. What I can tell you, though, is that throughout at least October of 70, they were never, rocket pods were never slung, at least not to my knowledge. And in fact, when we did SEAL ops and PSYOPs and got to use the slicks in a combat role, the only thing we used were free gunners, free M60 gunners and door-mounted guns, M60s. At no time through October were they ever did they ever carry rocket pods. You asked about 500-pound bombs that were used for LZ clearing. I heard about this, but and I heard that they did in fact drop them on an experimental basis. And I believe one time they used them as a bomb on a target. But those were, I think that occurred after I left country, or all I can tell you, James, is that I did hear that it was done. That's about all I can say. Okay, the next session you ask about is about Bob Baratko. And I'll tell you the whole story about what happened that day. I was involved in it, so I feel a little qualified. I'll tell it from my point of view, what I did, what happened to me, and what I observed, and what I know to be fact. And you can fill in the holes from other sources. Hold on just a minute, and I'll get a little organized. Okay, the action began on the morning of 15 September, 1970, at a place called VC Lake. That was a name given to it by the Americans, obviously. It's west of Sonondock, down in the Comal Peninsula. The coordinates of the lake are Victor Quebec, 905, 905. The story, as it was pieced together later, was that in that morning at dawn, a regional force platoon was inserted on the northeastern bank, or near the northeastern bank of VC Lake, and immediately encountered heavy resistance. In fact, during the insertion of the platoon, I believe there were four or five or six Army helicopters involved in the insertion, or Vietnamese, I'm not sure whether they were Army or Vietnamese helicopters, but all of them were shot up so bad that they had to return to base. None of them were shot down, however. Recognizing the intensity of the hornet's nest they'd gotten into, the Army executed what they call an automatic rise in echelon, something similar to that. What it amounts to is if the platoon can't handle it, they go to company level. If the company can't handle it, then they go to battalion. Anyway, this thing worked its way up throughout the day to quite an effort on the part of the Army. Okay, that platoon, recognizing the trouble they were in, the Army was not going to send any more troops into that exact spot, and the operation that they began was an insertion of troops farther to the north and to the east that would sweep toward the lake. And the idea was that they would trap the Viet Cong, slant NVA, between the advancing troops and the and VC Lake. They began this operation somewhere around midday, the insertion of troops and new troops, etc., on the periphery of the area. That platoon sustained several casualties right at the beginning there, and it consolidated its position and got on the radio and was trying to get a medevac. Sometime around noon, I suppose, or early afternoon, the platoon got a hold of the Army TOC in Kamau, the town of Kamau. Here's where the follow-ups began. The duty officer was not there when the call came in, and an Army private or corporal or something took the call for a medevac from the Vietnamese platoon, and the corporal wasn't aware of the fact that the Army didn't want anybody else to go in there, and he treated it as though it was a normal medevac, request for medevac. So he called and got a medevac and called the Seawolves to supply air cover for the medevac. The Seawolves, by the way, had not been informed of the action that had taken place in the morning and had not been informed of that there was a big Army operation going on there at the moment. All they got was a call for support for an air evac, a medevac. Two DETs responded, four aircraft. They were the aircraft from Songhondok and from Kamau, and I believe that was DET 3 and DET, 5, 6, I can't remember. DET 1 was all the way down in Nam Can. There were three DETs actually within flying distance of the area, but two of the DETs responded, four aircraft. Let's see, three of the aircraft that I know were involved were Bill Pedersen, Rich Lambert, Bob Baratko, and the fourth aircraft commander, I can't remember his name. The four of them arrived almost simultaneously and checked in with the medevac, and the medevac, the actual circumstances from that transpired in the next few minutes I'm not real clear on. Perhaps you can get this from some of the other people, but apparently two of the aircraft went in escorting the medevac into a marker that the platoon had supposedly laid out, and it was suspected that later on, or suspected later on, that it was not a legitimate marker. It was a plant by the Viet Cong to set up a helicopter trap. Anyway, the medevac went in, encountered extremely heavy fire. The two aircraft that escorted him in, I believe, were shot down. Those were the two that were shot down. Two Seawolves were shot down, I believe, escorting the medevac in. Bill Pedersen was flying one, and he crashed, hit a dike line in his flare, and the aircraft flipped over and killed Bill Pedersen and a crewman named Jose Ramos. Les Ford was his co-pilot and was banged up terrifically bad. Bill Pedersen went in and crashed, was shot down and crashed, and Rich Lambert was shot down, shot up, lost his engine due to fire, and he auto-rotated into the middle of VC Lake. VC Lake was about 6 or 8 feet deep, and Rich did a superb auto-rotation, set the aircraft down, and very gently the aircraft sank into the water, into the mud on the bottom, and all the crew got out and climbed onto the top of the aircraft. The medevac, the other two aircraft immediately came in, I think, and this was Bob Baratko's aircraft and the other fellas, and I can't remember what was happening then. I may have these escorts mixed up. Okay, I know who crashed, and I know what happened to the other aircraft, but I'm not sure exactly the time at which these things happened. Bob Baratko was shot up. He had fuel leaking from the bottom of his aircraft, and he elected to stay around. The other aircraft that went in got his control shot up and literally wandered over the horizon. He couldn't control the aircraft. He did make a successful landing back at Kamau, however, a while later. I understand it was a pretty exotic landing. Anyway, the medevac The original medevac got out of there. He was shot up, but he got out of there. Was not fatally hurt. And he immediately went over to VC Lake and picked up Rich Lambert and his crew. Hovered alongside, they jumped on board. Bill Pedersen was staying around this whole time, and they, even though he was shot up and leaking fuel, Bob Baratko was staying around with his aircraft, even though he was shot up and leaking fuel. They then elected to go in and into that same area to pick up any survivors from Bill Pedersen's aircraft that had crashed. Bob Baratko stayed around, and he was the only gunship available to escort the medevac in. And I can tell you that it was, in fact, a real helicopter trap. I've never seen so much fire in one place in my life. Anyway, Bill went in and got himself shot up some more, but he covered that medevac from the tree, put enough fire on the tree lines on both sides of the crash so that so that the medevac was able to put out the crewman, Rich Lambert and his crewman, and they went over to to Bill Pedersen's aircraft and pulled out Les Ford, the co-pilot, and the other crewman who was alive. They got him back into the medevac, and the medevac took off, and Bill Pedersen was down to fumes on his in his tank. He supplied fire support the whole time. It was really an outstanding effort, and certainly a lot of courage on his part to be staying around when he was in that kind of shape. Anyway, he did make it back to Sonnendock, landed at Sonnendock just barely with the fuel he had. I arrived when the medevac was setting down on Bill Pedersen's aircraft, when they were going in to pick up Bill Pedersen's aircraft. I had been down at Seafloat at NAMCAM all that morning doing psyops with one of the slicks. We got the call that Seawolves were in trouble, and it took me about 15 minutes, I guess, or 10 to 15 minutes to get the loudspeakers and recorders and all that jazz out of my aircraft, and then I took off with another slick. The other slick stopped off and picked up some troops. Perhaps this is a little later. He went over and picked up some troops out of Sonnendock. These were Navy sailors who volunteered to try and set up a perimeter around Bill Pedersen's aircraft if it was needed. Okay, I arrived overhead when Bill Pedersen, when the medevac was pulling the crewman from Bill Pedersen's aircraft out. I called, asked if they needed any help. They said no, they had they were just getting out of there, and the medevac was low on fuel. Bill Pedersen obviously was low on fuel, and they flew out, and the last word I got from the medevac was that they had picked up six survivors and had left two probable KIAs in the aircraft. I decided then that I had, based on that, they switched off the radios, and based on that information, I decided that it was worthwhile to try and get another aircraft in there to see if, in fact, they were dead, or in any case, to try and recover the bodies if they were. I believe it was about this time that the other slick decided to go over and pick up some troops. He picked up, went over to Sonnendock and picked up those sailors. And in the meantime, I tried calling the Army, who had also, or all during this time, had continued their insertions about 5 miles away to the north, those insertions I was telling you about earlier. They had obviously a number of slicks making those insertions. They also had guns circling overhead. I couldn't get a hold of any of them. It took me about 15, 20 minutes to get a hold of somebody. I finally got a hold of the CNC ship that was conducting the operation. And he, in essence, said that no, he was not going to allow any people into that area, because it was so bad. Captain Twite showed up in another slick about this time, by the way. He was had been flying near the area or something and heard about it, and he came in and came over. Two Val-4 ponies came, started circling overhead, too. Well, I was the only slick that had door gunners. I had picked up, my door gunners had picked up M60s before we left Namcan, left Seafloat. And so I decided that it was worthwhile for me to try and make this effort. So I made a low pass over the crash to see what kind of fire there was. And boy, there there was some coming out of tree lines on both sides. I finally got went back up, and I figured I had most of the positions of fire, most of the places where the fire was coming from pinpointed. And I climbed back up. In the meantime, somebody had gotten a hold of the Army CNC ship again, and he agreed to allow two Army guns to escort me. These were Cobras. So I went down and made my, made my approach next to the aircraft, and the aircraft had flipped over into a deep canal, and it was about chest-deep water. My crewman got out, waded over to the aircraft, confirmed that both Bill Pedersen and Jose Ramos were dead. Bill Pedersen was jammed into the aircraft so badly that there was no possible way to get him out without there being a ground party there for quite a while to get him out of the aircraft. The nose of the aircraft had been crushed in and around Bill. The crewman, his body was floating free, so my crewman dragged his body over to my aircraft and attached his body to my to the skid of my aircraft while I was hovering there, and with a gunner's belt. They climbed back in, and we took off. While during the stay on the ground there, my co-pilot was returning fire from the tree lines with his M16. So it was quite an exciting evening there, or afternoon. I took off. The two guns were or followed me out, and one of them was shot down right behind me. The fire was extremely intense. I remember it being almost a solid sound. If you've ever heard machine guns, so many machine guns going off that you could not distinguish any particular shot. If it was just one solid roar, that's what it was like. 50 cal tracers looked like big basketballs coming up at me. Anyway, I got out of there. We took a number of hits, but we got out of there. Nobody additionally was hurt. The gun that was shot down behind me was immediately rescued by another slick that had showed up while I was on the ground. In fact, that slick did an outstanding job. He followed that gun right on down. As he rotated down, the slick was right beside him, and the crewman jumped out of the gun and into the slick, and they probably were on the ground 20 seconds. So it was an outstanding rescue made there. I was real low on fuel by this time, and I flew over to Comal and landed. And that was the end of the incident for that day. There were so many casualties, so many aircraft shot up, and so many aircraft lost that there was a real stink created. A lot of animosity arose between the Army and the Navy down there because of the lack of coordination, because the Navy was not aware of what was going on. The Army didn't tell them about the big op, didn't tell them about the danger in that BC Lake area. A lot of bitter, very bitter Navy pilots. The Army was bitter also in that we had stuck our nose in where we didn't belong, and or where they thought we didn't belong. And there were a lot of charges and countercharges made until finally kind of an informal investigation was made by a General Cushman, who was an Army Brigadier General in charge of all, I believe it was all aviation assets in Fort Corps, Army aviation assets in Fort Corps. And he came down and held an informal investigation of the incident, which is the subject, I guess, of another story. But as far as commenting on the performance of Bob Baratko, he was nominated for a Medal of Honor for his action that day, and I think rightly deserved. As the only gun available to that slick, I can pretty much guarantee that slick wouldn't have been able to save those six other Navy crewmen if Bob hadn't been there and stayed around to give that slick the cover he did. And with his aircraft and the condition it was in, it was quite a performance. It went in as a Congressional Medal of Honor and was downgraded to a Navy Cross. I think I'll wind up the story by saying that the Bill Patterson was, his body was recovered the next day. The Army stopped inserting troops on the periphery. So to that extent, we did foul up their operations by getting involved with that medevac. The reason they did was in order to recover the aircraft they had lost and to help recover Bill Pedersen's body. They inserted troops around that area and beginning the next morning. And however, there was no resistance met. The North Vietnamese had left during the night. Bill Pedersen's body was recovered out of the aircraft, about 100 meters, I believe, from the aircraft. It was stripped, but he wasn't mutilated at all. Let's see. That pretty much winds it up. I think in total it was something like 10 to 12 aircraft shot up. There were, the Army had lost several shot down, another one on the perimeter, and they lost, of course they lost the one that was shot down behind me. Army had several casualties too among among their crewmen. So the whole thing was kind of a bad day at Slippery Rock for everyone, I guess, except the NVA. It was later learned that where that platoon had been inserted was the division headquarters for that 9th NVA division that I was telling you about earlier. So they did have quite a few anti-air assets there. Well, that's the story on Bob Baratko and the incident at VC Lake. I'll stop here and wind up with a few other comments here. In order to complete the picture of what happened at VC Lake, I have to tell you that I've lost track of Bob Baratko. I don't know what happened to him. When he left Vietnam, I believe he went back east to a anti-submarine squadron. I don't know where he is now. I'll give you the address of Rich Lambert, who was the guy who auto-rotated into VC Lake. He might be able to fill in some details. His address is Richard W. Lambert, L-A-M-B-E-R-T. Address 1265 Montego, M-O-N-T-E-G-O, number 40, Walnut Creek, California, 94598. He's gotten out of the Navy now and is working for a real estate company, I believe, or bank, I believe, in Walnut Creek. The other fellow who might be able to fill in some details is Les Ford, who was in Bill Pedersen's aircraft. I saw Les after I returned from Vietnam, which is, 2 weeks later. I saw him about a month later. He had worked his way through the hospitals back to a VA hospital in Bremerton, Washington. Les is from the Seattle area, the Puget Sound area. I talked to him in a hospital there, and he was suffering from an amnesia that encompassed 24 hours prior to that day and all the way up through about 2 weeks after in the hospital afterwards. He may have recovered some memories, though, since I've last talked to him, and you might be able to get some information from him. The only address I have on him right now is Northeast 1100 Stadium Way, Pullman, Pullman, Washington, 99163. If you don't get him there, you might try his folks. I don't have it would be in care of his father, O.C., initials O.C. Ford, and the only address I have is Nordland, Washington, Nordland, Washington, 98358. And that's probably a country post office, so it'll probably get to his father. Well, I hope I've been some help to you. Since I've written to you, I've mentioned your project to several other friends that I've kept track of who were in PAL 3 about the same time I was, and encouraged them to get a hold of you. So I hope that in your efforts to get all this information together, you won't lack from resources anyway. Tape's almost done, so I guess I'll just sign off. Feel free to write me again or send me a tape if it's easier for you. And I wish you the best of luck on your project. Goodbye.
This tape was produced as a reference to assist in the preparation of a paper on the history of Helicopter Attack Light Squadron 3 for the American Aviation Historical Society.